This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to the New Books in German Studies podcast, a channel on the New Books Network of podcasts. I'm Michael O'Sullivan of Marist College, one of several co-hosts with the New Books in German Studies podcast. Today, we are fortunate to have Sarah Thompson-Vieira as our guest. Dr. Thompson-Vieira is Assistant Professor of History at New England College in New Hampshire. We'll discuss her book entitled Turkish Germans in the Federal Republic of Germany, Immigration, Space, and Belonging, 1961 to 1990. Published in 2018 with Cambridge University Press. The book is based upon research initially done for a dissertation that won the German Historical Institute's Fritz Stern Prize. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Sarah, I'd like to open the interview today by asking you to share a little bit about your professional background and possibly a little bit about your personal background. Specifically, how did you become committed to a career in German studies? And how did you particularly become drawn to the history of Turkish guest workers in Germany?
Well, the answer to that question takes us back a bit, because I have been interested in German history since I was an undergraduate, and actually became interested in Germany specifically because as a high school student, I was lucky enough that German was one of the languages that they offered. So by the time that I got to college, I knew I was interested in history. I thought I was interested in politics. And so I started taking history classes, and the first professor that I had, his area is modern Germany, and he was great. Like he was enthusiastic. He was passionate. His classes were interesting. And so I was pretty much hooked into German history from that first semester. So when I was out of college and I was trying to think about what came next, a friend of mine mentioned the possibility of graduate school, and said that they pay you to study history, which I thought was the most fantastic idea ever. But I knew that if I went back to school, I wanted to spend my time studying something that had a contemporary resonance so that it could sort of keep my interest, but also help me to make sense of the world I lived in and not just the world of the past. And I was fortunate enough as an undergraduate to be able to study abroad in Berlin. So I got to see the multiculturalism of that city as a young woman. And so when I started thinking about what sort of project I could do as a graduate student, as a sort of apprentice historian, the idea of doing something with immigration in modern Germany was really appealing to me. So that's sort of what I came in with when I went to graduate school. And you know, from there on out, it held my interest, and it just took me down so many different paths of considering topics such as belonging and citizenship, immigration and immigrant settlement, and that it was something that that was interesting to me personally, that was something that had a contemporary resonance that I could sort of attach to, and was something that was really intellectually stimulating and posed a lot of questions and had me sort of going in different directions trying to answer them.
Great. And I do think it's a very interesting topic, and I really appreciated your contribution. As someone who studies Germany but isn't a specialist in this particular field, I really learned an awful lot from the meticulous research you did here. Before we delve into the book itself, I'd like to ask you about your title, and particularly about the first part of the title, Turkish Germans. It seems politicians, members of the media, academics, and activists sometimes disagree about terminology for the large population in Germany that descends from Turkish guest workers. I personally, and again, as something of a non-specialist here, have heard German Turks, in the case of this book, Turkish Germans, in Germany, Germans with a migration background sometimes. The Green Party politician Cem Özdemir has even famously, but I think consciously, referred to himself as an Anatolian Swabian, if I'm not mistaken. So can you explain maybe how you chose the title of Turkish Germans and maybe reflect a little bit on some of these terminology issues?
Sure. As you pointed out, there are a lot of different ways to talk about people, to talk about identity in Germany, in modern Germany. And depending on who is doing sort of the labeling, it's clear that there are particular identifiers that some parties are more interested in, like Germans with a migration background is something you'll hear much more in sort of public policy, public discourse. And in the field of Turkish German studies, I think the two that we tend to favor more are either Turkish Germans or German Turks. The title, like much in the book, underwent a lot of revisions sort of in the process of moving things from a dissertation to a manuscript to finally a book. And the publisher and I and the editor sort of we hit back and forth between each other, sort of tennis played the title out. And at one point she was thinking more Turkish immigrants in the Federal Republic of Germany. But I really felt like immigrants referred very specifically to the first generation who immigrated, you know, who moved to Germany. And I felt like the continual identification of the second and then third generation as immigrants was inaccurate and was something that until recently has been something you've heard more in the public discourse in Germany. But to continually to refer to these people who were born in Germany, raised in Germany, went to German schools as immigrants was, I think, a strong sort of political statement and a way of separating them out from Germans. So in the field of Turkish German studies, we go back to Turkish Germans or German Turks. And I prefer Turkish Germans because for me, when you think about these words and about what they mean, the putting Turkish first and German second identifies them as Germans who have a Turkish background, Germans who are citizens, who are residents, who are, you know, students, who are coworkers and colleagues, but who are also Turkish. And I thought that to switch that around, to call them German Turks, is to say that they are essentially Turkish, but they are just more German than other Turks. So that's why I personally choose Turkish Germans. Now, you can ask someone else this question, and I'm sure that they could give just as good a reason to talk about German Turks. But this was the identifier that I thought was the most accurate that could describe both the first and second generations that I was studying and I was writing about in my book.
Thank you for that explanation. Moving into the content of the book a little bit, I'd like to talk about how you open the book. Your introduction, like many of your chapters actually, opens with a great anecdote. And this anecdote comes from an oral history. And I was wondering if you could summarize your opening anecdote for the audience. And then, and this is part of what I think makes the anecdote work so well, explain how it represents really the main thesis of this monograph and the argument that you make throughout it.
I was very fortunate when I was doing research in Berlin to have met Ursula Trupper. And in the 90s, Ursula did a series of oral history interviews in Wedding, in the district of Wedding, and then compiled those for for an exhibit that was at the Mitte Museum in Wedding, that was on immigrants in a particular neighborhood, on Sparplatz, that was in Sprengelkiez. And I got to meet Ursula Trupper and talk with her about the interview she did. And also, as you mentioned from reading the beginnings of each chapter, many of those are from the interviews that she did that I was able to read later. The anecdote that you're talking about is one of my favorites because I agree it illustrates very clearly what follows in the book, sort of what my argument is and how the history of Turkish Germans unfolds. And so the anecdote itself is about Eren Kesken, and that's a pseudonym. I changed all the names of the people from the interviews that I found. And then if the interviews that I did, if they wanted pseudonyms, I did that as well. But he was born in 1960. He was born in Turkey. His parents were working in Germany. They eventually brought him over as a sort of young man. If I remember correctly, he was maybe 13, 14. They brought him over to live with them in West Berlin. And it was quite a transition for him getting settled in, but he did. And he sort of sank himself down into this neighborhood. He got a job. He married, he started a family, and then he became the owner of a kneipe, so a little pub in the district that I focused on in my book. And so he's a young man, he's married, he's a business owner. And Ursula Trupper and another man went to his place of business to interview him one day. And so they're talking with him about what the neighborhood is like. And of course, his customers are also chipping in because this is a neighborhood place and they all hang out there in the afternoons. And so Ursula is asking them, you know, how is the neighborhood? What do you think about it? And they're talking about, oh, how it used to be great, but now, you know, kids are hanging around and they're doing drugs and the economy's really gone downhill since the wall fell and reunification. And all those guys that are coming over from the East, they work super cheap. And so it's hard for these guys to hold jobs and to get jobs that are decent paying. So they're all of these guys, so Eren Kesken and his customers are all sort of saying these things that we understand as being common sentiment among a lot of West Berliners and West Germans even at that time in the early 90s. You know, the wall's fallen and Germany as a country is sort of trying to figure out how all this works economically, and also sort of politically and culturally. So they're talking about using all of these idioms and all of these tropes that are so familiar to West Berliners. And then someone asks, I think it was Ursula Trupper asks, so are you going to get citizenship? She asks this to Eren Kesken. And he just sort of, you can sort of imagine him throwing up his hands and he's like, we have black heads, you know, we have black hair, basically. Everyone knows we're not German, you know? So even though he has just spent the last however long, he and his clients have spent the last however long totally sympathizing and speaking the words of fellow West Berliners of frustration about how reunification is going, when she asks about citizenship, when she asks him about changing his passport, he immediately then distances himself from this and says, you know, I'm not German. Anyone who looks at me can see I'm not German. And so of course not. And I find that particular interaction and Kesken's answers as being really reflective of the sort of the fact that integration is something that happens in pieces and in different places in different times. And I talk about this in the book as being spaces of belonging, so that there are spaces in Turkish Germans' daily landscapes, the second generation, the first generation, where they have made spaces for themselves to belong, that they have changed and been changed by the environment they live in, and that in these places, they are integrated into these particular places and spaces. But at the same time, the conditions of that can change in a way that can then make them feel like outsiders instead of insiders, or can reinforce something that that makes them identify with not being a part of that community. And so that was why I was particularly interested in looking at in my book, this idea that integration is not some sort of linear progression, that you start at one point and that you end at the other point, and you can say that these people are integrated, past tense, done, you know, close the door, but that this is an ongoing process that can change dependent on the particular political or historical climate, where they are in the course of their day, who is around them, and even the discussions that are happening around them. So that is, that's where I felt like Eren Keskin's story, or this part of his story, was so reflective of the larger Turkish German community and its place within West German society and then reunified Germany society.
Well, personally, I always enjoy histories that sort of capture the messiness of history and sort of question these larger sort of assumptions that are either out there and, you know, existing narratives, or maybe the media too sometimes. And yeah, so this notion of an integration that, you know, has space for contradictions really interested me. And yeah, and this book, as you mentioned, in many ways is a spatial history. And just, you know, for the audience who haven't seen it, right, you sort of organize your chapters around space. You look at the workplace, you look at the home, you look at schools, religious sites, and so on. And just to make clear for the listeners too, when you talk about the district of Wedding, right, this is a district within Berlin, within West Berlin. And so as a book kind of organized around space, right, the first chapter of the book examines the Turkish guest workers' experience within the workplace. And this chapter has lots of interesting elements to it. And I kind of viewed it as something that had these two sides to it that really compelled me. On the one hand, I was very interested in your analysis of German businesses, right, and how they acted toward Turkish guest workers, especially after the government, the West German government, ended the guest worker program in the 1970s. But on the other hand, you also focused, as you do through the whole book, on Turkish guest workers' agency, right? And of course, nothing sort of articulated this agency more than when Turkish guest workers left their initial workplaces and began starting their own businesses in West Berlin and in West Germany. So I was wondering if you could reflect on the one hand on what German businesses did, and then on the other hand, how Turkish guest workers themselves sort of created spaces in the workplace.
Sure. As you mentioned, this is a book that it very much draws on cultural geography, on social and cultural geography. And so as I was thinking about how to tackle and how to organize my approach to this, I thought about the different places that Turkish guest workers in the first generation were brought over to sort of inhabit. And the workplace is definitely that first space. And so you have then in my first chapter focusing on the different types of workplaces that that the first generation sort of settled into. And I looked first then at West German businesses, because these were the sort of the draw for these Turkish workers to bring them out of Turkey, to bring them over to West Germany. And then in the sort of late 60s, early 70s, especially West Berlin, to work in these jobs that they couldn't get enough Germans to fill, or in the case of women, that they wanted to be able to maintain sort of the conservative political outlook of German women not having to work full time so that they could be home when their kids get home, which Monica Matthes wrote a great book on guest worker women, looking specifically at that phenomenon. But you end up with a lot of female guest workers in West Berlin, you know, partly for that reason. And so I looked at, largely I looked at bigger companies like Siemens, and how they, starting with the sort of advertisements that they did in Turkey to sort of introduce potential Turkish employees to what their company would be like, to get them to apply to come over. And Siemens and AEG Telefunken, they were very organized in this, the recruitment of workers, but also trying to then sort of fit the workers into the particular company molds that they had for them, and to educate them as to what their sort of rights and responsibilities as employees of this company, these companies, and as sort of residents, foreign residents in West Germany and West Berlin. And one of the things that I found particularly interesting when I was looking at these companies and the documents that I was able to find from them that were relevant was company publications that were for these guest workers that would be put out. There's usually be like a page or something in the company newsletter or the company newspaper that would be specifically for their guest worker populations, their guest worker employees. And it was fascinating to see the things that the companies thought that the guest workers ought to know or that needed to know, or that would be helpful for them to know. And a lot of that had to do with, you know, this is where you go to access your healthcare needs, or this is the office that you talk to if you want to organize vacation, or, ones that I thought were particularly relevant and interesting. This is what you do to extend the permit for your residency in the city or in the country. So this is what you do in order to make it so that contract that we said was going to be, you know, 2 or 3 years, if you want to stay longer, here's what you do to be able to stay longer. So these companies were not particularly interested in having the same kind of turnover and their workforce that the government had initially instituted in these temporary guest worker programs. The companies had brought in these workers, they had trained these workers, the workers now knew their jobs, and they weren't interested in this rotation principle that was supposed to be a part of the guest worker program. So the companies were actively educating their foreign employees to be able to use the system to stay longer. And then while they were doing that, there was this interesting social and cultural element of what the companies sort of offered their foreign employees. They would say, you know, the German equivalent of all work and no play makes Joe a dull boy. And so they would say, you need to have hobbies. But you should have hobbies that are German hobbies. So you should have a football team, you know, a soccer team. But you should make sure that that's not a soccer team that's like this city from Turkey versus that city from Turkey. You know, you should work together on these football teams. Or some that really began to skirt or cross the line from being helpful to being really patronizing. Like, you shouldn't leave your trash in the stairwell, or you shouldn't, you know, sort of trying to teach them, this is how West Germans live. So if you're going to live not in the dormitory, then you need to be aware of these are the sort of the ways that West Germans behave. These are the expectations that they have. So you need to, and at one point, this was a phrase that was actually used, you know, sort of disregard your Southern temperament and sort of adhere to the social norms of where you are. So the companies were trying to make their guest workers, to encourage their guest workers not just to stay, but also to integrate into society in a certain way. And the workers themselves were, one thing I found was particularly interesting was that they were also using these workplaces in ways that would, that were contrary to the expectations. So there was that famous saying, like, we asked for labor and people came. So these are people now, and they're people who want to live out their lives in certain ways that are not necessarily in line with sort of political expectations for them. So they want to start families. So there was one woman I interviewed who, she came over as a 17-year-old. Technically, you were supposed to be 18, but she and her dad lied on the application and said she was 17. So she came over to West Berlin as a 17-year-old and decided that after being there for a couple of years, she wanted to get married. And she wanted to move out and into the neighborhoods, and she wanted to start a family. And so while the companies are educating, trying to educate their workers, you know, to be good workers and to stay longer and, you know, to be a limited, at least, part of society, they're not necessarily thinking, we want them to get married, we want them to have families. But the workplaces that these guest workers inhabit are places where they start to build social networks. And the dormitories, the company dormitories that they live in, are places where they are building these social networks. So this young woman who comes over decides she wants to get married and uses those social networks to effectively find herself a husband. And so she finds herself a husband with some help of some friends and relatives. This is all, you know, outside of the oversight of her parents. She lets them know afterwards, which during the interview, she sort of said as an aside, I wouldn't recommend this, you know, telling your parents afterwards that you've gotten married. She's like, it didn't go over well. But so she gets married, she has kids, she settles in West Berlin, which eventually becomes reunified Berlin. And so I'm interviewing her in like 2008 or 2009. And she came over initially on a, you know, 2 to 3 year labor contract. So between the company sort of educating her in a way to help her continue to be able to figure out how to stay there legally and longer, and the social networks that she built up within the space, within her workplace, this sort of space of belonging that the workers created, that she built a life there that actually helped her to settle in to West Germany in a way that was unanticipated by the people who were sort of making these programs and making these contracts, and that sort of reflects the ways that many other of the first generation were able to use these workplaces as jumping off points into a longer term settlement and integration into society. And I think that the case of then the Turkish-owned businesses is another great example. And that sort of starts to come to the fore, I think, really more in the, if I'm remembering right, like in the 80s. So you start to see this more, you start to see some of this in the 70s, but really more in the 80s is you start to get much larger numbers of and multi-generational families in West Berlin. The jobs that the Turkish guest workers had, some of them were able to use those initial jobs to forge useful careers that this would be long term. But more often than not, Turkish guest workers would switch sort of from company to company, to, you know, wherever they could, you know, get a better wage or was more convenient to home or that they felt like a more stable place. But it was, you know, workplaces are not always particularly stable. And between economic difficulties, which would cause these companies to either do cutbacks or to move out of the city, or problems that some Turkish Germans had or Turkish guest workers had in the workplace, Some decided that they wanted to open their own businesses, that they saw this as an opportunity to be their own bosses, which for a certain segment of that population was a really compelling reason to try to go on their own and have their own business. And so it was difficult initially for Turkish residents, for foreign residents, to be able to open their own businesses. So in many cases, they would need sort of a German front man who would be the official head of their business. But the Turkish owners would actually be the ones who were getting the capital, who were finding the supplies that they need, who were, you know, finding the location, who were cultivating sort of a customer base. That would all be these Turkish entrepreneurs. And so you started to see the rise of businesses that at first, some of them were focused definitely more on the Turkish immigrant community, on the Turkish German community, and feeding meeting needs to those particular potential customers that their German counterparts didn't anticipate. So you had people who were opening businesses that assisted in travel. You had ones that opened businesses that had to do with particular food types that you couldn't find in other places. And then there were barbers, and then there were tailors, and there was the coffee shop. So all of these different kinds of businesses that were meeting a need that was not being met already in these particular markets. So, but as in many other historical, you know, sort of environments, being a small business was also a rather unstable thing. And some of these, many of these businesses didn't last particularly long. Some of them did. Some of them became very embedded in the neighborhoods that they were in. A couple in Sprengelkiez that were around, you know, in the late 70s, early 80s, when I went to do my research, were still there, were still thriving concerns. And so, the entrepreneurs in these businesses would, some of them would try to sort of stay in their own sort of niche, and some of them would try to branch out so that they would have a broader customer base, so that it'd be more stable economically that way. And then with the rise of these businesses, sort of changing the landscape visually, that started to feed into the perceptions of West Berlin residents, of German West Berlin residents, who saw their neighborhoods changing, who now in the 80s, even though the guest workers had been there for some of them, you know, 15, 20 years, when you get to the early 80s with the rise of the Turkish owned businesses and multi-generational communities, that's when German folks in Wedding specifically, since that's what I'm looking at, start to look around and think, oh, well, all of a sudden there are a lot of Turks, which isn't the case, but visually they became much more present than they had been in the past.
I feel, although it's not the central argument of the book, or not a part of the central argument of the book, you really do use gender as a way to analyze all the material you're working with. And in the middle of the book, you have these two chapters that focus on the home on the one hand and on the neighborhood on the other hand, as sites where Turkish Germans created cultural spaces and a sense of belonging. I was really compelled here by your discussion of Turkish women. And in some cases, it seems you show how these women were restrained by Turkish patriarchy, and in oral histories expressed resentment at this situation. In other sections, you show how women nonetheless became very active agents in Turkish-German integration, and how they sometimes rejected West German media reports about repressive Turkish masculinity as overblown. So this is obviously a very sensitive issue, especially considering the way the West German media became kind of obsessed with topics like the veil and things like that. But I was wondering if you could discuss the complex role that women's experiences play in this book.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
Yeah, that's a great question. And it definitely played a significant role in my research and my writing of the book, because Ursula Trupa, the woman who, the historian who conducted the interviews that I was so fortunate as to use, she herself was a volunteer at the Sparladen, which was a neighborhood center in Spengelkiez that came about from these two German women who wanted to serve the immigrant community, especially wanted to teach kids language through play, to provide safe places for women to communicate with each other and to sort of build relationships between the German and Turkish women in the community. And so she, in the early 90s, conducted several interviews with 11, 12, 13-year-old girls, Turkish-German girls, and that I felt really did a great job at offering a window into sort of their thoughts and their actions, how they understood themselves, how they understood sort of gender roles and the ways that they were rebelling against them. And I think that the Sparladen itself is a really good example of this. So I'll try to use that to sort of tackle this big question in a more concrete way. So the two West German women who started Sparladen had a very definite idea of what this space was supposed to be about. They wanted to be able to, one of them was, she was involved in education and she was just absolutely shocked at the fact that so many Turkish German children were going to the Sonderschule, were being sent to a school that was for people with physical and with learning disabilities. When these children did not have physical or learning disabilities, they didn't have the language skills that they needed yet to do well in the Grundschule, in the elementary school. And so these women thought, well, if we can, get kids together, if we can help them learn German when they're still little, then that will set them up so much better for school. And that will solve, any number of social ills. So these women, they start playing with the kids at the park and they meet the parents and try and cultivate good community relationships. They get this space that they call the Sparladen, and it's on Sparplatz. So it's on this, sort of park square in the center of this part of the neighborhood. And they have language lessons and they have play times and they have classes or sort of times for specifically for young women who are sort of early mid teenage years, because they want them to be in a place that is safe, where they can express themselves, where they can be apart from parts of the community that they find oppressive or overbearing. And so Sparladen is created. And the community does use this space, but they don't use it particularly in the way that the creators wanted it to be used. And I think this is a great way in seeing how methodologically how space works. So this place was created with these certain intentions in mind, but the people who use this space began to develop and change those, what it was intended to be, into what they wanted or want what they needed to be. So it starts out that, if you're in the space, you have to speak German. If you speak anything else other than German, you have to put a penny in a jar or something like that. But, within a couple of years, the place is largely, the language spoken largely is Turkish. So there are these kids in there that are talking in Turkish, and their mothers, when they're there, are talking in Turkish. And so it becomes less a place of integrating German or Turkish people, Turkish first generation or the Turkish German kids, into what the West German women thought would be the most useful way for them to integrate into Western society, and instead becomes a very social place that in some ways meets these sort of goals, but in others don't. It does become a place for young women to come and to congregate and to hang out together, and to in some ways, yes, like escape the oversight of this neighborhood, because these women, when Trupa talks to them, they do talk about how they feel like they are watched in the neighborhood, how the other Turkish residents in the neighborhood watch what they're doing and then tell their parents if these people think that they're doing anything that's wrong. And the women, young women experience that as something that is oppressive and is frustrating, and that they do want to fight against. But they are able to come to this neighborhood space and to have sort of this free space to talk amongst themselves, which is something that they find particularly useful. At the same time, not all of the young women consider themselves as fitting sort of the mold of what West German media and some of their West German neighbors consider sort of the young Turkish German woman is supposed to be like this. And so they're rebelling against that image, what that's supposed to be. And then at the same time, they're rebelling against what that their nosy neighbor, sort of the social policing that's going on, what that wants them to be like. The roles that their parents play in this, their mothers and their fathers, is different for the different girls. Like some of them say, my parents don't mind. Like my parents can say whatever, can say I can do, you know, basically whatever I want. They just want me to be safe. Another young woman's parents is very overbearing. And so there are all these different pressures and expectations on these girls as they're trying to sort of figure out who they are and how they want to fit into this community, this community life. And I think that, I think another way that's helpful to look at this is when you think about when they go to Kur'anshule, their attitudes toward Kur'anshule are another reflection of this. So none of these young women, all of them had gone to Kur'anshule. One of them had gotten kicked out for misbehaving, but all of them had gone. And none of them were really prepared to say it was bad, that it was a bad thing that they learned about Islam, that it was a bad thing that they learned about these different traditions, because they saw it as part of their Turkish heritage. But none of them particularly saw the value for it for them in the moment. So they were at a different place at that time, and that part of their identity was not something they were interested in. And one woman even very, you know, deliberately put it that was for when she was older, and maybe for her kids that would be good, but for her right now it wasn't who she was. So there are all these different expectations and stereotypes sort of being laid on these girls, and they are sifting through it in the late 80s and early 90s and trying to figure out where they fit in it. And this is before even the headscarf debate happens, because at least in Vetting and in the neighborhood I'm looking at, the headscarf isn't even really an issue until the 90s. So all of this that's going on is going on sort of prior to that headscarf debate. And the only time in all of the pictures that I was fortunate enough to find of this neighborhood in this time, the only time you ever see headscarves are on much older women, or are on girls and women when they are in these Kur'anshule lessons, when they are at the mosques, in public spaces, in schools, in the homes, in the workplaces, it's not part of the debate. So it's more in those points about behavior than it is about appearance in that sort of way.
Excellent. Thank you. And I think your discussion of the Kur'anshule is an interesting segue into my next question. And although I think many of our listeners, as it's a podcast about German studies, know German, but for those who don't, Kur'anshule is, you know, a school for the study of the Quran outside of school, which is also a situation that's kind of particular to Germany and also particular to its Muslim population. But you have, this great chapter on religion. I myself am a scholar of religion, and I really appreciated what you did with it here. And I think you do a lot with this chapter, so I'd like to give you free realm to say what you'd like about your chapter on religion. Although I was particularly struck in this chapter by how you argued that the revolution in Iran in 1979 fundamentally changed how Turkish Muslims were viewed in West Germany by other Germans, and how that then, you know, caused them to perhaps alter their outlook and their behavior and possibly their cultural practices. So I was wondering if you could reflect on that chapter a little bit, and particularly on this sort of year 1979 as a rupture.
Yes, that was something that I found as I was looking through German newspapers and trying to get a sense of what German perceptions of Islam and of Muslims were in sort of the earlier years of the guest worker program, of Turkey's participation, especially in the guest worker program. And then moving into when you started having the development of multi-generational communities, I was really interested in learning about, well, what did Germans think Islam meant? What did they think of Muslims? What were their perceptions of these people? And prior to 1979, most of the articles that I found in German language newspapers, any mention of Islam or of Muslims was about things that were happening outside of Germany. And it was focused more on sort of cultural events or architecture or, you know, things like this that were just sort of interesting, non-threatening, and beyond the borders of Germany. But the Iranian Revolution, and then of course the Islamic Revolution, and the change for Iran to becoming the, you know, Islamic Republic, that as you said, that significantly and fundamentally changed the ways that West Germans thought about, or, you know, at the very least, the way that West German media portrayed, and the way that West German politicians portrayed Islam and Muslims. And so where before Islam was, you know, it was this interesting sort of beyond the borders, you know, historically rich, but non-German thing, you know, that was far away. Now, all of a sudden, Islam was something that was political, that was revolutionary, that was secretive, and that was embedded in the German landscape in these different places. And the West German media and politicians very quickly focused on the prayer rooms, so Turkish prayer rooms, and the Quran shula, the Quran classes specifically. So these moved from being so if you think about it sort of geographically, these move from being in the courtyards, you know, in sort of the background of people's thoughts, very much onto the street front. And so now there were all of these articles with these, you know, fantastic pictures that were just really expressive, that talked about the hidden dangers of Islam, that talked about sort of this, the potential for this revolution, because it was the political side and the cultural side that was seen as being particularly threatening, because these now was not something that was outside of Germany, but it was something that was in Germany and that was a threat to Germany. So the pictures you would see and the descriptions that would be in the articles would be about sort of these you know, heavily bearded men, or these women who were, you know, shrouded in garments and you couldn't hardly see any of them. There was this one picture that had, it was just a frame of people all bowing down, you know, in the same direction in prayer. But because they were bowing down, you couldn't see faces. There was nothing personal about them. The point of that picture and of the article that attended it was that there were all of these sort of mindless people who were just following these dangerous mullahs who were being influenced by radical Islam that was coming out of Iran, and that this was something that was fundamentally dangerous to German culture and society and that needed to be addressed. So that is what you get, you know, in 1979 and in the early 80s in West German media and West German politics. This idea of the internal danger of Islam and of Muslims, and, you know, the fact that that most Turkish immigrants and their children were considered Muslims, and that they were then sort of these potential radicals who would be undercutting German values. So politicians pretty quickly started focusing not on the prayer rooms and mosques sort of generally, but very specifically on the Koranschule and on the lessons that the kids were learning in those Koranschule. And there's all sorts of speculation on how they were being taught to hate Jews, how they were being taught to hate Germans, how they were being taught these gender differences that were unacceptable in German society, how there was definitely a radical nationalist element to them. They mentioned the Grey Wolves, and just the danger that this posed to German society, because these were the kids, right? The Turkish German kids that were being educated here and who would be staying in Germany ostensibly. Although, that wasn't necessarily something that was explicitly said, like they're here, for good. So we need to do something different, but that they're here now, they're going to grow up and they're going to, be a part of our communities, and we need to do something about this. So that's when you start getting the push to move education on Islam and on the Quran out of these unregulated, these dark, these oppressive, these politically radical prayer rooms and mosques, and move them into the public schools, which are overseen, which are lighter, which are controllable, where West Germans could then sort of tailor what these kids learned about Islam and about being Muslim in a way that would fit, that they thought would fit into West German society. So that's when you start really getting the push to do that, to sort of wrest control of the children's minds, is sort of the way that they thought about it, from these potentially dangerous mullahs who are teaching these things to the kids that will make them estrange them from German society, and place that into the well-regulated and brightly lit. I mean, it's very much dark light continuum in most of these articles, so that you can protect the kid and keep them from. And one of the articles I think was something like, mosques drill hate into children, and so we don't want to drill hate into children. We want them to live in harmony with the rest of the Germans. So that's what you're getting from the articles in the late 70s and the early 80s. On the flip side, I looked at Hürriyet, which is a Turkish language newspaper that they have, of course, there's the edition that's published in Turkey, and then there is the European edition. And in Hürriyet, the articles about mosques and what mosques are something very different. I mean, they are posited as something that they're very much a center of community life, of maintaining traditions and customs. But also, and this is something that marks the mosque as a site in West Germany as something that's very different from how it's sort of posited in Turkey at the time, they're places of national identity. So you don't just come to the mosque because you are Muslim and because you want to participate in communal recognition of certain religious holidays or whatever, but you come because you're Turkish and because that's where you can be Turkish. And that's especially importantly where your kids can come to learn what it means to be Turkish. And there's a lot of language in these Turkish language articles from Hürriyet that talk about how the youth especially are losing their Turkishness. And so the mosques are places where they can learn what it truly means to be Turkish, and that can sort of save them from being lost then to West German society and to the values on the other side. So, while the German articles are stressing sort of the political radicalness and cultural radicalness, the Turkish language articles are are positing that there was, in one of the articles, it's titled "Politics Has No Place in a Mosque." Like, this is not a political place. This is a place of religion. This is a place of culture, and this is a place of national identity. So if those are things you want for you and your kids, is sort of, you know, the selling point, then come into the mosque where you can relieve the feeling of pain that comes from being abroad, because it's always about, you know, the people who are living there are abroad. Because the true home then is Turkey, in the context of these articles. The mosques are here for you, and they're the place where that can happen.
Well, Sarah, not many historians discuss how the fall of the Berlin Wall affected Turkish Germans. As the chronological endpoint of your book is 1990, you end with the fall of the Berlin Wall and reunification. Therefore, your final chapter helps fix this problem. Can you explain for our audience how reunification changed the life of the Berlin Turks who you study so carefully in this book?
Yeah, that was something that I wanted to be able to finish the book with, this because I am the person who always wonders what happens next. And so I wanted to know what happens next. And I wanted the people who would then come and read this book also to get the opportunity to know what happens next in the lives of the people and the community organizations that I looked at. Looking at Germany more broadly, Naveem Chil has written on this, and she's done a great job. And I just focused mostly on the neighborhoods and the peoples that were in the book. And so when the wall falls, initially there is excitement. And this is something that I think also reflects how the Turkish immigrants and how their kids have become a part of these communities and have absorbed many of the same expectations and hopes and plans that their neighbors have. So there's a lot of excitement when the wall comes down. One of the women that I interviewed said that when they heard the wall had come down, she and her dad got in a car and they drove and they were so excited, and they went over into East Berlin and then they came back to West Berlin, and she was crying because she was just so glad. Another man who I interviewed said that he was leading a youth group at the time, neighborhood youth that had, German youth and Turkish German youth in it. And they were super excited, and they went out to the train stations and they found some East German youth and they brought them back to their church and they had this party and got to know each other well. And so there was a lot of sort of that initial fervor that came along with that. But then the consequences, the economic consequences, to start with, were really, really felt hard in Wedding and as in the rest of West Berlin. But a lot of the companies that the Turkish Germans had worked at, that had brought them over, that had been these good jobs for them for a long time, they started moving out of the city, and they moved into the, one man called it the Speckgürtel, and I'm not quite sure how you translate that, like the bacon belt. I don't know, the area around the city that was much cheaper to operate in and was getting all of these funds now to develop so that they wouldn't be these economic sinkholes. So companies were moving out. There was a bicycle manufacturing company that moved out. So one man lost his job for that. I think Sarati moved out. I don't remember. But so jobs were moving. Like, these workplaces themselves were disappearing out from under the feet of these people who worked there. And so that was a very difficult thing, because I'm going back to terminology now, employees with Turkish background were much more likely to be in these sort of jobs that disappeared. And so the unemployment rate among the first generation of Turkish immigrants was always higher than it was with German workers. And so they definitely suffered disproportionately due to the economic upheaval. And then, so politically and culturally, and Naveem Chil talks about this a lot, there's this whole discussion about Germany is reunified. What does it mean for us to be German? Oh, the Germans are back together. And the Turkish Germans are sort of standing there and they're thinking, you know, I feel like we had just about gotten into this German society thing. And now all of a sudden it's being redefined as in what is German. And that is focused almost entirely on bringing these two halves of Germany back together, and not on the recognition of the fact that West Germany is now this very multicultural place. And so what does that mean to bring, you know, the former East Germans into that and to bring, you know, the two halves of Germany together? And so so the focus on multiculturalism, multicultural relationships then begins to be superseded by this sort of, you know, sort of pan-German identity, this idea of what does it mean for us to be unified and German again, one Germany again. So that's difficult. And then, of course, political upheaval and economic crisis opens the door to radical political groups. And so you have the rise of the extreme right again, and especially in places that are particularly economically hit and disadvantaged. And that lends a very different sort of voice and sense to these discussions about sort of fitting it into German society, when it becomes something that is not just difficult, but also in some places, dangerous for people with a Turkish background. So those are sort of all of these things are going on at the same time. And then in the 90s, you have a lot of purpose-built mosques going up. Or I should say more. I don't know how you would quantify a lot, but and that is something that is very much changing visual landscape of some cities and causing a lot of uncertainty and distress in certain parts of the population who see these mosques as sort of physical embodiments of something that is not German, and that is sort of displacing Germanness and sort of putting this firm anchor hold of something that is very foreign into a landscape that used to be very familiar. And so while some have argued that, and I argue to an extent that the growth of these mosque communities and of these umbrella organizations and the building of these mosques represent that this community is sort of coming into a maturity and now can deal with and communicate with and work with similar organizations within Germany. And so they can be platforms for sort of very productive work. Other people are seeing them come up as sort of a foreign invasion and an example of something that is threatening to them, getting that much more of a foothold in their environment. So the 90s are a very interesting time, especially in Berlin, and I think especially for the Turkish German community in trying to balance between the sort of their everyday lives and the extent to which their everyday lives are changing, and then these larger political and cultural questions that are going on around them at the same time.
Well, excellent, Sarah. And we've taken up an awful lot of your time. And I'm sure that this book has taken up an awful lot of time in your life. It was quite a project, and it's clear that it involved a lot of meticulous research and also a lot of deep, sort of insightful thinking. So now that you've finished this, I was just wondering what's next after the book?
Well, there were things that I came across while I was researching the book that I would love the opportunity to get to investigate more. There was a lot of cultural creativity in West Berlin, and especially in Wedding. I feel like Wedding is just really overlooked. But I spent a lot of time there, and there was a lot of really exciting things going on there in the 80s when the city was focusing on what they called decentralized cultural work. So not so much city focused or city organized and controlled cultural production, but the city sort of saying it's your responsibility. You know, if you want this cultural life, you kind of need to do it. So a lot of folks in Wedding were like, yeah, you know, we can do this. And so you had really interesting centers of cultural exploration like Fabrik Osterstrasse that brought in people from all different kinds of backgrounds from the neighborhood. And so there were musical groups, there was poetry, there were, you could take music lessons there on everything from the saz to sort of traditional German instruments. There were all kinds of just the dynamics of the place that were very interesting that I would love to get into more and see how, so the interplay between the Volkshochschule, so the local community college, and the art scene, the multicultural art scene, that would be interesting to look at. Also, something that starts happening, I think, more in the 90s, so it's a little bit soon, but you get a growth of interreligious dialogue. And there's not really much of that in my book because there wasn't much going on in the neighborhood at the time. And in fact, one man said, we tried to do this and it no one came. But then in the 90s, it starts to be something where different religious organizations are starting to talk together and think of themselves as common actors in a community. And seeing how they can work together to sort of, you know, address community issues. And I think that those sorts of sort of organizational dynamics are another thing that would be really interesting to look at. That said, I'm an adjunct. I don't have ready access to an academic library. I don't have institutional funding, and I have two young children. So, whether I'm going to be able to pursue these or other interests that I have anytime, you know, very near in the future is more than a little up in the air. So these days I've been focusing much more on developing the courses that I'm teaching to bring in these questions of identity and belonging, to introduce my students to ideas of to think spatially, to bring in sort of cultural geography when they're thinking about history, when they're thinking about people interacting with each other. And I developed a class on Muslims in modern Europe where we read part of my book and compare it to things that are going on in France and in Great Britain, and talk about the ways that the different contexts in which immigration and community settlement formation come about, how those are influenced by different historical backgrounds that bring in these immigrants and within these different countries at the same time. So, that's what I have been focusing on more recently and has been a really interesting task for me.
Well, Sarah, I can tell you that one of the things I enjoy most about doing some of these podcast interviews is that I read books that I ultimately use in my own classroom. And I've been trying to focus my own modern Europe class and 20th century Germany class more on issues of migration. And there's lots in your book that will make it into my classroom as well. With that, I think we should wrap up our interview. And so, Sarah, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's been great.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, thank you all for tuning in. You've been listening to New Books in German Studies, a channel in the New Books Network of Podcasts. I am Michael O'Sullivan of Marist College. We have discussed Sarah Thompson Vieira's book today. The book is entitled Turkish Germans in the Federal Republic of Germany, Immigration, Space, and Belonging, 1961 to 1990. It was published with Cambridge University Press in 2018. We hope you'll continue to listen and tune into our episodes in the future, and we'll catch all of you listeners next time.